land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand and walk this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be.
Well, good evening. Happy Shabbat to one and all. JB, I see that you've joined us here. I've got a question for you.
Okay.
Is your life satisfying?
I'm pretty happy with it.
You happy with your relationship with Patty?
Yes.
You enjoy being a dad?
Love it.
So do you feel like when you wake up in the morning, it's not, oh, good God morning, it's good morning, God?
I don't know. I'm not that much of a morning person, but, yeah, I'm still happy. I'd rather be sleeping in a little bit. I don't like getting up early.
In a world filled with people who have to drug themselves into oblivion to cope, in a world full of people who immerse themselves in the artificial realm of social media because their own lives are just too meaningless, you're living a productive, satisfying, happy, loving, and fulfilling life, aren't you?
Yes.
Kirk.
Yes, sir.
You, you're married like JB is to a covenant member.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
life's good, isn't it?
It's pretty good.
You're satisfied with each day and with the opportunity to study Torah and to share what you learn? Do you feel like that's satisfying and fulfilling?
Oh, yes. No question.
Yeah, and you know, we're not talking now about, you know, people in church, you know, how deep is your faith? You really love the Lord. No, we're not talking about that at all. Real. Is life satisfying? Is life fulfilling? In a world where people are distracted by the unreal realm of social media, of the internet, where they're spending 7 hours a day on average watching other people live their lives, where the majority of people are abusing one form of drug or another, where life is drudgery, it's pretty extraordinary to be around people whose lives are genuinely satisfying. I think it's one of the great benefits of the covenant. It doesn't mean that our lives are perfect. I mean, I've got things that, you know, with family that I would like to be different. But, boy, on the whole, each day is just a spectacular opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
It is just so eminently marvelous. And that's one of the things that I'm finding. The more I studied Dode, and I'm writing the commentary now for the translations I've done for the second chapter of Volume 3 of Observations for Our Time. And you just listen to the insights that are provided, particularly by Dode, and what God has to say about him. And you realize, you know, the guy had his aches and pains. He had lots of people that were gnawing at his heels. He had lots of people that really hated him. he had family issues, just like the rest of us. And yet, you know, his life was stunningly fulfilling and enriching. In fact, his resume reads that God gave him the titles of beloved, son, Shemek branch. He is the Melech king, advisor of Israel. He is the Mashiach, anointed Messiah. And there are places where Yahweh calls him the Savior. In fact, there are places where Yahweh says of this man, when I return, the person I'm bringing back with me is Dod. And he's not only going to shepherd my sheep, that's one I forgot to add to that list, shepherd, but he's going to deliver and save Yahudah and Israel. You know, when it comes to doing the dirty work and cleaning the muck off the streets, when Yah returns, he's going to do it through Dod. The one guy who was always committed, and this is the thing that I love about him and everybody else seems to hate about him. So many people complain that Dod was too preoccupied with those who were his enemies and who were adverse to Yah. It's perfect. When Yahweh returns, he's returning with Dod, and Dod's got the biggest broom in the universe, a broom comprised of the Spirit, and he's going to use it to wipe the streets of the broad and open way clean of the muck that has been so deceiving. And then through his intellect, through his character, just by being right, he's going to lead everyone to a more enriching and opportunistic situation. It's enormously fulfilling and gratifying. So different than what the world has to offer. Well, before we leave the story of Lot, his illegitimate sons, Moab and Ben-Ami, and the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, let's consider something from the prophets which underscores the importance of what we have observed over these past weeks of months, especially in identifying modern Moab, which was really the purpose of this exercise, and determining the fate of the current incarnation of Moab. Since understanding comes by way of Bien, making connections with what we're going to consider, we're on the cusp of comprehending something essential to understanding prophecy. Zephaniah, whose name speaks of Yahweh storing up and hiding his treasures so that they might be discovered and appreciated at another time. What a great name. Mm-hmm. I'm named Yahweh stores up and hides his treasures so that they might be discovered and appreciated at another time. Isn't that kind of our whole shtick around here?
Yeah.
Now, God hid these treasures awaiting our discovery. And when we find them, we not only appreciate them, but I think God appreciates us discovering them and sharing them. He was the son of Cush, who was the great-grandson of Hezekiah. Grow and prevail with Yah, Hezekiah. He spoke for Yahweh during the reign of Zedekiah. Yahweh is right, Zedekiah. Zedekiah was actually Nebuchadnezzar's puppet in 597 BCE. Now, we'll be diving into this prophecy, which has been partially but not completely fulfilled. So much of it is addressing our future. God is reminding us of his disdain for nations and the impoverished human conditions that they inspire. Kirk, I know you love history, and... You know, JP, you work in academia. Can you name one civilization, that was upstanding, where the leaders treated the people with respect, where they taught which was appropriate and true, where they guided people in an appropriate way. They didn't take advantage of them, where they were kind to their neighbors. Can you name one?
Outside of
a handful
those.
Of times throughout Israel's history.
Yeah, there was a brief period here and there, but those were fleeting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly didn't happen with the Egyptians. It didn't happen with the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Persians, the Babylonians, the Sumerians, the Carthaginians, the Spartans, and the New World, the Aztecs, the Incas, the Mayas. None of them. So it's just the nature, the countries, civilizations are really nothing more than stubble within man's clay building blocks and sticks to kindle fires. People are devoid of hope. No one is satisfied. So this begins, this is Zephaniah 2:1. It's an amazing prophecy. It says, choose of your own accord. It's amazing how many times we see the imperative mode, which is second-person volition. Now, Hit-Pael imperative is a really interesting adaptation of the verb. Kashash is the verb, which means to gather as if the straw it was used to make bricks. So to gather the straw, which is used to make bricks, to pluck up and collect as stubble something. It means to do it without any interference or motivation from outside forces. Do it on your own initiative and of your own choice, the imperative. So choose of your own accord and capacity to gather as if the straw used to make bricks or as a collection of sticks used to make fire. O impoverished nations and Gentiles devoid of hope. Or build whatever you want to build. You know, spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. Build the most beautiful capital building in the world. Go ahead, build it. You're just nothing but an impoverished nation, devoid of hope, and the straw that you're putting in your bricks is nothing but a collection of sticks to kindle a fire. You know, this notion that God loves nations and God bless our country and all of that sort of thing, God's exactly the opposite of that. He has no respect for countries, and he shouldn't.
He has no respect for
these him. Nations will not be spectators celebrating Yahweh's return, but instead defendants at a trial where the opposing counsel has never lost a case. There will be no acquittals, no plea bargains, and indeed no hope. Matter of fact, I was translating, I think it's the 18th or the 20th Psalm, a Mizmor. And it just says flatly, God does not listen to their prayers, and he isn't going to save them. Oh, that's what's being said here. What follows destroys the Christian expectation of either a rapture or a second coming. And while I do not know if there's a connection between the next sign Yahweh will raise up during the last days and this choke and grave prescription for living, it's clear that God intends to make himself known to those who are willing to listen. Before being deprived of an extension of time and prior to the communicated prescription of what one should do to live, which has been inscribed, being brought forth, similar to the chaff passing away the day before being deprived of time, he will find that there is no harvest or inclusion for many of you. Only the intense hostility of Yahweh before lives are interrupted and then suspended. He will discover that there will be no return and thus no second coming for you all on the day of Yahweh's righteous indignation and intense animosity. You know, I was, it's like 4 or 5 chapters from here, because this is the first half of chapter 11 of volume 2, and then the second half of this, and 12 and 13 of volume 2. 2, and then a chapter 1 and a chapter 2 of volume 3. And then it wasn't by intent, but by the time we were towards the end of volume 2, we have completely and totally, the Word of God has completely and totally destroyed one of the most pervasive and destructive myths in human history, the second coming of Jesus Christ. He isn't returning. That's just an absolute statement of fact. He isn't the King of Israel. He isn't the Good Shepherd. And he's not coming back. Stoth is coming back with Yahweh. And it is just so obvious, and God makes it so abundantly clear. And you just want to scream, not to Christians, because most of them are far too lost to ever have any hope, but to Yisrael and Yahudah. You've missed your Messiah, and he was right before your face. You missed your King, and he is among you. You missed it all. It's been doed all the time, right there, inviting you home. And it is so obvious, so irrefutable. And that's much of what this is saying. For the Christian, there's no second coming. And you might, there's some technicalities in the statement. One of the technicalities is that it says that life is about to be suspended, and it speaks of for the chaff. What do you think that means? That life is about to be suspended.
Before they get burned up, or before they're all there in that burn, before they get thrown.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what happens is that it's Yahweh's intent to conduct the trials of everyone he's going to judge concurrently.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard for us because, you know, we think, well, you know, trying, there's got to be, you know, 10 people whose trials could go on for months of years. And there's some that, you know, you would expect to be a long time, and there's so many souls that have lived that, you know, everyone who has died apart from the covenant is going to be judged. The vast preponderance of them are going to go into the suspended state and just be passed in back into oblivion. But God's going to be thorough. He's going to be fair. It's just that I think that the nature of Yah and the nature of time is that it can all be done at the same time, so we're not worn out by it. And because we can be in more than one place at one time, we can be it in all of these that we choose to be. As many of them or as few of them as we wish. And that was, you know, I had one of my favorite people who's just been really helpful in editing these books. And, you know, he wrote me a letter. And his question was one of time, which was, he's saying, how is it possible that the prescriptions of the Torah, which, you know, are comprised of the five conditions of the covenant, empowered by the first four, Moed Mikre, how is it possible that they in and of themselves could have saved the like of Dod before Yahusha fulfilled them? How would you answer that one?
Well,
Yahweh exists outside of time.
Yeah.
Yes. Awesome. Yeah. Then from Yahweh's point of view, the moment he spoke to Abraham and Yishak on Mount Moriah, during Pesach, in year 2000 Yah, and he said that, don't touch the boy, don't harm him anyway, I'm going to provide the Pesach lamb. When God made that promise, he had planned this out a long time previously. You know, it'd be another 600 years before he would enact that promise during the Exodus, freeing them from slavery and the crucible of human oppression. And that amount of time before he'd reveal the specifics of this plan to Moshe in the Torah. And 2,000 years from our accounting, from that moment that he spoke to Abraham, before he would actually himself fulfill the role as the Pesach lamb, as Yahweh saves. But that's our perspective on time, because as physical, mortal individuals, we look at time as past, present, and future.
Yeah, linear.
Right. Well, Hebrew doesn't have past, present, and future.
It just exists.
The spiritual realm doesn't have past, present, and future. It all is. When Yahweh made the comment, he had already fulfilled the comment. He'd already fulfilled the promise. Just becomes one happened after the other, just shows our limitations stuck in time. And so the Passover lamb doesn't save. It's what the Passover lamb represents that saves. All the Passover lamb does is provide for a very delicious and nourishing meal. One that can be enjoyed with covenant members, family, and friends, and that can be celebrated for what the Passover lamb represents, which is Yahweh himself fulfilling Pesach. That's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say they reenacted it. The thing that triggered you was Asher. And
mm-hmm.
It triggered me because I always thought in terms of the priest would always place their hands annually on the lamb and
mm-hmm.
transfer the sins of the people onto the lamb. So they were reacting a future event to them.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
as you say, so to me that was, that didn't need to be done in their time. Number one is, I agree with you, it's all irrelevant because he's not stuck in time. But for them, they needed to see it. So
right.
they did a physical thing in front of them, and they
right.
understood that that was not
the right.
lamb.
And the lamb was simply symbolic
yes.
of Yahweh fulfilling his promise. You know, Yahweh saying, I will provide the lamb.
Right.
It caused me, because it's becoming obvious, I mean, overwhelmingly obvious, that the role of Yosha compared to the role of Dode
mm-hmm.
is overwhelmingly different. I mean, they do work together, but the Dode is amazingly more important from God's perspective. And when Yahweh is talking to Dode and said, he's my shepherd, I took him from the sheepfolds, and I caused him to be the shepherd of my flock. And I did so because of his superior intellect, because of his character and his sense of right and wrong, his good judgment, and because of his leadership skills. And, you know, how many Christians think that, oh, you know, Jesus is the good shepherd? No, I'm sorry, it's doubt. In fact, Yahweh even says he's the right, good shepherd.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, finally, I just wanted to lay it on the line. The shepherd is not the sheep. The sheep is not the shepherd. Who is Yahweh? Who is Yahusha? Excuse me. Who is Yosha? The Passover lamb.
Passover lamb. Here is the lamb.
Is the Passover lamb the shepherd?
No.
No. Was Dode the Passover lamb?
Hardly.
Dode was the shepherd. The shepherd and the lamb have a symbiotic relationship. One without the other is useless. Dode is the shepherd. Yosha is the lamb. They have different roles. The lamb's role to provide that sacrifice. It's the shepherd's role to provide everything that is insightful and nourishing, good, and to guide us to the best possible outcome in relationship to that lamb. And for those that, you know, might have a conniption fit over this, and I think there were a lot earlier, and my precious Jesus, even if you're no longer a Christian, you know, how dare you, and particularly with the rise of the Messianics and Jews for Jesus and Hebrew roots, you know, where they try to combine Pauline Christianity and rabbinical Judaism. You know, I've said so many times that a God who would create an inferior being to worship him isn't worth knowing. A God who would draw a claim to himself would be a narcissist and isn't worth knowing. A father who would lord over his subjects such that they would fear him isn't worth knowing. A God who would crown himself isn't worth knowing. Why on earth do we think that God's going to crown a diminished manifestation of himself? That he's going to brag about a diminished manifestation of himself? That he's going to cause a diminished manifestation of himself to inherit Israel when he himself created the entire universe?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. This idea that somehow Yahusha is being diminished because Yahweh gives Dode every important title. He gives him the title of Messiah. He gives him the title of Beloved. He gives him the title of Son of God. He gives him the title of being the Shepherd. He is literally given the title of Hand of God.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way we ought to see Yahweh. He created the universe and conceived life in the hopes that he could have a father-son, a father-daughter relationship with his creation. And the best at it in human history was Dode. So why shouldn't he be celebrating that man's life, that man's understanding, that man's intellect, that man's beautiful songs? And why in the world would God celebrate a diminished manifestation of himself, which he had all along? Why would he even bother to create the universe? Why bother to create the covenant? Why bother to inscribe the Torah? Why bother to serve as a Pesach lamb if your highest calling is to put a crown on your own head?
Good point. Exactly.
So you're not diminishing the role that Yahusha played as the Pesach lamb to recognize the Dode as the greatest achievement in human history from Yahweh's point of view. The very purpose of God taking the diminished role and serving as the Passover lamb was to enable the kind of relationship that he had with Dode. And that's why he's celebrating it. And that's why we're bringing everyone's attention to him. That's why we celebrate his words and his life. And that's why it isn't a knock on Yahusha. But Yahusha is not nearly as important to God, not even a fraction of the importance to God, as his Dode. And by the way, it isn't Dode alone. It's everyone who takes Dode's testimony and life seriously, who comes to know Yahweh, who engages in the covenant. All of us are so important to God, he would individually lay down his life just for each and every one of us, individually. Dode may be the best among us, but as the best among us, he enables all of us to enjoy the same benefits. And by the way, I'm not the least bit envious of Dode. Dode inherits Israel. He inherits the whole earth. He is the King of Kings when he returns.
That's a big job.
Literally the hand of God. I wouldn't want that job. Man, I want to tell you, I have listened to those who tried to lead Israel, and I don't want that job. I mean, understand, I love Yehuda, I love Yisrael, I'm doing all of this. Actually, I'm doing all this for Yahweh because he loves you. We all are. But I wouldn't want that job.
Nope.
I'm glad it's Dode's. I wouldn't want the responsibility of scoring the lyrics for songs that God himself would sing. But I'm glad Dode did. I wouldn't want the responsibility of assuring that everything that you write is precisely 100% accurate throughout all of time. But Thoth embraced it. And I'm glad he did. We're the beneficiaries. I'm thrilled just to be able to read it and enjoy it and learn from it. And we know, you know, we've been wrong. I've been wrong lots and lots of times. It doesn't matter. Because we've had all the opportunity in the world to get it right. It's very different than the role that Thoth played. He could never be wrong, at least when he was writing Ms. Moore. You know. So as I've shared, what the reality is that what we just read destroys the concept of a rapture. It destroys the concept of a second coming. And yet, it doesn't in another way. There is a second coming. It's of doubt. So therefore, deprived of an extension of time prior to the communicated prescription of what one should do, which has to live, which has been inscribed. When we read, as a long time ago, so this is really unfair to ask, but do you remember there were four terms that in the 109th Mizmor, which is a song to the Torah, there were four terms that Thoth repeated over and over again. You recall what those four terms were, or just one of the four? That's not a fair question. I mean, we've asked, a lot of time has passed. I'll answer it. Choke was one of the four. Pakuta was one of the four. Mishpat was one of the four, as well as Mitzvah. So the Mitzvah, the terms and conditions of the covenant, Mitzvah, that means that Yah uses to resolve disputes for those who exercise good judgment, the Pakuta and the Choke. Choke is from a Hebrew concept meaning to inscribe or to engrave. That means to chisel something, words in stone, so that you know they're enduring and dependable. And it's about what one should do to be cut into a relationship. And so before the prescription of what one should do that has been chiseled into stone is brought forth, I think there's a number of things that could be alluding to, and it may be all of them. Mm-hmm. I don't believe anything. I think, based upon what we have heard and read, that the original tablets next are in the Ark of the Covenant are going to be lifted up during the second half of the time of Jacob's trouble. That is really something that's engraved in stone. We know, based upon what we have heard from these prophetic pronouncements, that there is a neck which is comprised largely of Thoth's words and Yahweh's Torah that is being written by a choder that Yahweh himself is going to lift up. We know for certain that there is a Nakri, an observant foreigner who is going to reveal what Yahweh has said in such a way that Yahweh himself says you need to listen to him and you need to do what he says. Not because that what he says has any merit, but because by being observant,
he has
written what Yahweh has said.
Yeah.
And then we know there's going to be a couple of witnesses. We know that Eliyah, my favorite, because he is just so dadgum sarcastic. I just love Eliyah. Is your God taking a bathroom break? We'll wait here. Let him get his act together. You know, it takes time. Maybe your God's taking a nap. I've got all the time in the world. We're in no hurry. Lavelia. And then an unnamed individual is going to be no nonsense. And, that's when we read that the prophecy that Shlomo Solomon had conveyed about the Nakre. It was, we're not getting around here. This is really serious. And Yahweh is using what we're doing to make a profound difference among his people, calling Yisrael and Yehudah home. These two witnesses are going to be no nonsense. They're going to be just like Eliyahu. I think based upon what I've read, that Eliyahu is going to be the witness to Yisrael and Yehuda. He knows them really well. And the unnamed witness is going to lambast the religious and political goyim and be no nonsense as it relates to what Yahweh's message is. Take it or leave it. So those, any one of those things could be the time prior to the communicated prescription of what one should do in life, which has been inscribed, being brought forth. And these individuals, similar to chaff, are on the cusp of passing away. They'll be deprived of time. And they're going to find out that the rapture that they had thought pertained to them, no.
Yeah.
There's no harvest or inclusion for them. Only the opposite of what they expected. With all their worship, with all their donations, with all their churches, their mosques, their synagogues, they expected to have earned their God's favor. But Yahweh hates them. He's going to reveal his righteous indignation and intense animosity towards them. Only the intense hostility of each own, the burning anger and hatred, intense frustration and enormous disappointment of Yahweh. And you might say, oh, that's really unfair. They did with the best they could. They tried to love God. They tried to live a good life. No.
No, they didn't.
They worshipped a false god. They hated Yahweh's name. They hated the chosen people.
They hate his language.
They hate his language. They hate his testimony. And instead of what he had to say and of who he is, they chose a god made in the form of a man, carried around a dead god on a stick, called him by Satan's title, the Lord, and completely and totally annulled everything he had to say. Yeah, darn right God's upset with him. It was all there for them. It was obvious that Paul lied. Obvious. It's obvious there's no New Testament. It's obvious there's no church in a relationship with God. There's no salvation by grace. That faith is useless. This notion that the Torah is comprised of laws and condemns and cannot save, it's ludicrous when you read what God had to say about it. And so, yeah, he's pissed off at them, at the religious. Righteous indignation is too nice a way to actually translate umph. He's furious. Zephaniah 2:2. Yahweh's treasures are stored up for another time. Now, these prophetic pronouncements are more germane to Protestants than Catholics, most of whom remain fixated on the Pauline notion of a rapture and of a second coming. But instead of a God arriving in love and eager to receive them, they will be horrified to learn that he is incensed and enormously disappointed, even hostile to them. In fact, he's going to have dough to wipe them off the face of the earth. He had offered to teach them, to guide them, but they dismissed his Torah and came to despise his people. There's a better choice, one which is guaranteed to produce the desired result. This is Zephaniah 2:3. You should choose of your own volition to seek, investigating and learning about, even desiring Bakash. Under the auspices of free will, decide to diligently procure information, discovering knowledge prior to choosing to be with Yahweh. All who are responsive, unpretentious, and straightforward, Ana, who are forthright in their responses and answers, of the earth who act upon and engage in his his mishpat, his means to exercise good judgment and resolve disputes. Seeking what is right, honest, and accurate, tzedek. While deciding to inquire about and learn what can be known, bakash again. And then responsibly replying, unpretentiously responding, by providing your answer in a forthright and straightforward manner. Ana again. You can expect that you'll be concealed and thus protected. In the day of Yahweh's furious response, enormous displeasure, and righteous indignation. This idea, this pretty little Jesus coming down in the sky with, you know, his sandaled or bare feet and his pretty little robe and with his almost feminized features, bull. God coming back, and he is really disgusted with what man has done. And he should be. And the people he is going to be the most antagonized by are the religious and political. Don't say you haven't been warned. He was consistent. To know him, men and women must open their minds, discard man's deceptions, search through the evidence he has provided in his Torah, exercise good judgment, make the proper connections, and then respond accordingly. The Protestant myth of thoughtless salvation through grace, or the Catholic doctrine whereby salvation is predicated on priests performing the sacraments of baptism, confession, and the Eucharist on their behalf, have served to contradict and undermine Yahweh's approach, which is to provide independent access through the individual's mind. Of all the people cluttering this planet, the vile souls masquerading as Philistines while terrorizing Jews are my least favorite. The same is apparently true with Yahweh. Indeed, Aza, Gaza, that's another example of the G that you were talking about, the Gan, being replaced with the Aleph. Indeed, Aza, which is Gaza, shall be abandoned and rejected, and Ashkelon, the pile of trash behind the gate of dung, of worthless garbage, approaching an uninhabitable wasteland. Ashad, those who deal treacherously and are violently destructive, cruelly assaulting, devastating thieves, will be driven out and expelled by midday, while Ekron, the uprooted, cut off and plucked away, will be uprooted and tossed away. I was watching something that I thought I would never do, but I have a friend that is just enthralled with scholastic videos of whether it be the Oriental Institute or somebody showing a teaching video lecturing at Harvard or Yale or some prestigious school. And dinner a couple of nights ago, the computer was on, and had this guy at the Oriental Institute talking about what has recently become known about the Philistines. Okay, today's Philistines, the Fakistinians, they are of what race mostly, guys?
Arab.
Arab. Yeah, Arab. Overwhelmingly Arab. The Philistines, first of all, I have a question. Were they indigenous to the land of Canaan and to the area of Israel? Do you know?
No, they're from Arabia.
I don't believe so.
Nope. Oh, no, they were not. Nope, they were not from Arabia.
Oh, they weren't.
And they were not indigenous. Prior to around 1700 or 1800 BCE, after 1800 BCE, there's a time, by the way, between 1750 and 1800 BCE, almost every civilization in the known world collapsed. I don't know if you know that, but there's a period of time where human civilization did a major reboot. That happens to be the time that the first Philistines appeared on the coast, Mediterranean coast, adjacent to Israel. Prior to that time, these people did not exist there. So they came in about 300 years after Abraham. This notion, so you have a little perspective on history of the time. Right around 1775 BCE, the ancient world, essentially, the civilizations essentially vanished. Now, the scholars don't promote this theory. They correctly promote the fact that just prior to 1800 BCE, almost every civilization in the known world collapsed. That's a fact. What they don't seem to want to put to that equation is what happened on the island of Santorini. Do you guys know what happened on the island of Santorini?
Big volcano.
Yeah, huge volcano. Blew the top of the island off. And with that great volcano and the resulting caldera collapsing into the sea, what happened?
Swallowed up the island.
A major tsunami. 500-foot more tsunami moving at probably 600 miles an hour. The most advanced civilization of the time, do you know where it was?
Minoans,
right. Far and away. This was before the Greeks had a civilization. Slightly before Troy. Way, way before Rome. Ever so slightly before Carthage.
Well, they had plumbing. That's how advanced they were.
Oh, they had indoor plumbing, yeah. The civilization, the Minoan civilization, which, by the way, was standard Babylonian fare. The god was the Lord. He was shown in the form of a bull, and Asherah was the mother god of the Madonna and child, and queen of heaven, mother of God, all that sort of stuff. So, essentially, they were Catholic. Within 15 minutes of the time that volcano erupted, the Minoan civilization was gone. Every civilization along the Mediterranean coast was gone. And because the Earth has this propensity to turn from west to east, which way does the winds blow?
East to west.
East?
Yeah, from west to east. And what is due east of Santorini?
What due east?
Tigris and Euphrates rivers.
Yeah.
All the way down through Mesopotamia. And so the ash that would have been in the air, the debris in the air, caused climate change. And all these civilizations collapsed at that time. So it was during the collapse of civilizations that these people whose DNA, whose pottery, whose altars, whose gods, every aspect of them traces to what was what existed on Cyprus and in what is Macedonia, became Macedonia and Greece. That's where they came from.
So when did the Phoenicians show up?
Phoenicians existed.
Always thought they came through.
Way prior to this mass destruction and extinction. Although their civilization was destroyed at that time, and it grew back in the same locations. But the Phoenicians existed right around that time. But this is south of Phoenicia. North of Egypt, south of Phoenicia, is five cities. And what they have found is that they had no writing until they wrote in Hebrew. They really had no significant artifacts until their artifacts mimicked those of their neighbors. And that that around the time of the Assyrian invasion, they just ceased to exist. They disappeared. And they could have disappeared for a number of reasons. One is the Assyrians wiped them out. The Egyptians wiped them out. They died of plague or malnutrition. Or they just fully assimilated into the neighboring Hebrew population. But they ceased to exist. And they haven't existed since.
So why does that lie continue to grow so easily? At some point,
it requires political correctness, which is the willingness to accept that which is absolutely not true. You know, there is no such thing as a Palestinian today. There hasn't been one for 2,600 or 700 years. By the way, they did.
The facts don't matter.
They finally found something that is interesting. They finally found the first ever gravesite of a Philistine within the last 10 years. And what they found is that the people were shockingly malnourished.
Really?
That they died very young and that they lived horribly painful lives. That's what they found. That those who were successful enough within the society to have something that was extraordinarily rare among the Philistines, which was a decent burial, that they died very young in excruciating pain, and they were as malnourished as anyone that the archaeologists have ever uncovered. Every nasty thing that Yahweh had said about them, including being foreign invaders, living worthless lives, turned out to be true. What was also interesting, as this archaeologist would speak about these people, he would say, listen, I can't tell you the fact that the gate to Gath, for example, is exactly to the dimensions and exactly the place that Yahweh said it was, and those who wrote about it claimed that the city is exactly where he said it was, that the people are as exactly as they said they were, that the artifacts that found among the people, including the plague they were given, you know, of the swollen privates, say, you know, you're going to go play with my Ark of the Covenant. I'm going to see to it that it hurts where the sun don't shine. And he caused a swelling of something that, okay, we'll get those boys' attention. They even found artifacts affirming that was a blight that actually occurred to them. And so this guy kept us listening. I can't tell you that the account written by those that we find in what is called the Bible is therefore confirmed by this, but I will tell you that what we witness here is exactly what they said had occurred.
Wow.
Right down to the smallest details.
And that only occurred, 1,000 years before Moshe wrote it? Or pinned it?
Yes. Well, you know,
there's either one hell of an oral tradition, or he had some inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that one of the places he said, now, everything is confirmed except one thing, this particular scholar. And he said that, you know, Gath, which was the not only leading city of the Philistines, but the largest city in the region at the time, he said that it was not destroyed during the reign of David. And therefore, you know, that account is just wrong. I said, no. No. Dod didn't go about wiping out enemies. Nor did any intelligent king during that today. There's no money in wiping out an enemy. There's no money in destroying a city. There's no value in doing so. You destroy armies and you tax civilian population centers. And you can't tax a community that is taxed just to survive because you destroyed their infrastructure and city. So Dod wiped out their army, and then had ultimate control over them. He didn't need to wipe out the people to the end. That, you know, a Syrian king came in and he did all that. And the, in fact, the story of him doing that is one that the Torah prophets and Psalms articulates, and it happened exactly that individual and exactly at that time. So one of the things that you find is that that prophecy isn't just the prediction of things future. It is also the accurate portrayal of things past. So indeed, these Philistine cities, Gaza, shall be abandoned and rejected. Imagine that now. I mean, Gaza is a literal beehive of snake pit, a wasp nest. People living on top of people in poverty. He says, it's going to be abandoned. It's rejected. That Ashkelon, the pile of trash, will approach an uninhibited wasteland. Ashdod, those who deal treacherously, will be driven out and expelled. While Ekron, the uprooted, shall be uprooted and tossed away. Those are the cities of Gaza. This notion that, you know, that's going to be part of a Palestinian homeland. Well, kiss your homeland goodbye. Yeah, kiss it goodbye. You know, the names of these places are sufficient to explain what God thinks of the sorry souls occupying them, fierce and forsaken, the damned and destitute, the disassociated and deserted, the abandoned and rejected, the pile of trash behind the gate of dung, worthless garbage and repulsive excrement, those who deal treacherously and are violently destructive, those whose assaults are cruel, whose thievery is devastating, statistically despoiling, while brutally ruinous, even the uprooted, cut off and plucked away. I guess God saw the same videos that I've watched about these same people. Either that, or he had a means of seeing what they'd be like long ago. Now, it could serve as the byline and mission statement of Hamas and the PLO. But rather than confiscating what does not belong to them, no matter how many suicide bombers blow themselves to smithereens, no matter what name they have selected to obfuscate their true nature, Yah was going to depopulate them, adorning them in the horror they inspired. They will be uprooted and tossed away. Good riddance. Now, when reading these words, it seems as if we were watching the news. And by the way, we're in Zephaniah. You know, Yahweh's treasure is stored up for another time. And now we're about to read 2:5. We're not here for these insights. These insights are just a bonus. We were here because I said there's a connection that is astonishingly important about Sodom and Gomorrah. That's why we're here. But every time we go to a place where Yahweh is providing insights, making connections so that we might understand, if we just take a larger swath of that discussion, we walk away enormously enriched. This is an example. So we're just warming up here. Woe to those who inhabit these places. Those who are wickedly offensive, engaging in boisterous religious parades in the region along the sea. You nation of Cretans and Philistines. The word of Yahweh is against you, Canaan. You and the land of the Philistines. I will destroy you, such there will be no inhabitants remaining. Zephaniah, Yahweh's treasures are stored up for another time. Zephaniah 2:5. I've said it on this program probably 25 times, and I'm not sure it ever really resonates. I want to try it again. The Philistines are unknown to human history apart from Yahweh's prophets. If it wasn't for Yahweh's prophets explaining their nature and their existence, no one would know that they even occupied this planet. You get that? They left no legacy. They would be wholly and completely unknown to humanity if it were not for the testimony of Yahweh's prophets. Therefore, if Yahweh was wrong, they never existed. If Yahweh was right, and he did, they are despicable. They embody every negative attribute that we just consider based upon their names alone. And the same testimony that's the only place that actually describes their existence and their name just said, woe to them. Woe to those who are wickedly offensive, engaging in boisterous religious parades in the region by the sea. You nation of Cretans and Philistines, the word of Yahweh is against you. Without the word of Yahweh, you don't exist. With the word of Yahweh, you will not exist. I will destroy you, and there'll be no inhabitants remaining. If the Torah, prophets, and Psalms is not true, then there is no such thing as a Philistine, and therefore a Palestinian. If it is true, God despises them, they don't belong there, and he's going to wipe them out to the last. I don't know why that's so hard for people to figure out. It is so obvious, so simple, that if you were to say Palestinian and Palestine, you're making a fool of yourself. You're showing your complete and utter prejudice and ignorance. Pretty straightforward. I don't know why people don't get it. Maybe it's because of the death of logic. It's such an odd thing.
Ignorance, apathy, and arrogance.
Yeah. And incorrectness. These worthless Islamic terrorists have fraudulently bequeathed upon themselves a name which is only known through Yahweh's Torah, Nabi wa Mizmor. God's testimony is reliable. They are foreign invaders who have no claim to the land. And if Yahweh's testimony is unreliable, there is no such thing as a Palestinian or Philistine. No matter how many morons they convince or how loudly they scream, the realization that this deceptive and delusional myth has been popularized to the point that it has become universally accepted demonstrates just how far mankind has fallen. And appreciate this point. For those who believe that religions are true because they are popularly accepted, and that nothing that is that popular, that has been upheld for generation after generation, could be untrue, consider the myth of Palestine and the Palestinians. Lies are popular. Myths prevail. It's the truth that is rare. God has not been deceived. He sees the so-called Palestinians for what they are: unproductive and belligerent, Satan-worshipping, anti-Semitic, foreign invaders, and terrorists. To make his home a safe place and a joyous place to live, he will eradicate these irritating pests. In fact, Gaza is exactly as Yahweh chose words to describe it nearly 3,000 years ago. What it is not what it will be. And the wickedly offensive governmental district, which sponsored boisterous religious parades along the seacoast, shall become beautiful pastures with meadows for shepherds to graze their sheep along with their folds and their flocks. When God Gaza is depopularized of, depopulated of religious Muslims when they're all gone. Then it will be a beautiful plain, a place for shepherds and sheep. Now, that tells us a number of things. First of all, for Yahweh to return the earth to the conditions of Eden, he's going to have to wipe every trace of the religious and their religious edifices, their homes, their buildings, their government, their militaries, off the face of the earth. But it also tells us, beyond the fact that the earth is going to be transformed into the nature of Eden, that they're going to be shepherds and sheep. If they're shepherds and sheep during the millennial Shabbat, what does that mean? How about this? There's work to do. In the Garden of Eden, Adam worked. God says, yeah, I want you to work. If you don't work, you don't have character. It's essential that we work. Even during the celebration of eternity, we're going to be working. If you don't work and you aren't productive, life ceases to have meaning. You know, this idea of being retired and doing nothing, somebody that does that's not going to live very long.
Those people usually die quick.
Yeah, they die quick. And so God is saying there's going to be work to do. More important, we're going to be eating. And we aren't going to be vegetarians. And the reason that he's talking about sheep is, guess what? We're going to celebrate Pesach.
Yeah. I grow wine.
On the menu.
On the menu, man. A lot to be said for that statement if you want to understand what the world is going to be like. The land best known for irresponsible parents turning their children into terrorists will have a higher calling. It's going to be used to graze the sheep of Yehuda. The homes of terrorists will be the barns for their animals. Then this region shall be for the remnant of the house of Yehuda, on which they shall care for their sheep, in the houses of Ashkelon, in which they shall lie down to rest in the evening. For surely Yahweh, their God, will be mindful of them, returning and restoring them from captivity. Yahweh is a God of retribution. That's important. We've talked about it before. But for the victims of religious, political, and military abuse, well, they aren't going to go to heaven as they may have wanted. And their souls will simply be eliminated. It isn't fair to them to have the souls of those who abused them, who misled them, be similarly annihilated. Isn't fair.
I agree.
And it isn't even responsible to dissipate the souls of those who were misled until they have the opportunity of knowing and of seeing that those who abused him paid the price. The victims of the Holocaust, for the large most part, their souls are simply going to cease to exist. But it is grossly unfair for those who suffered under the hands of the Germans and the Ukrainians and the Poles and the Italians. It is wholly and completely inappropriate for them to pass into oblivion without knowing that those who were so horrific are held accountable. I had a reason this morning to listen to the song of a gypsy. It was a woman who sang on the streets as a gypsy, a Roma. And a music producer found her, and now she sings in large concert halls. And there's a sadness in her eyes and a joy in her voice. And as I listen to her sing, and I think she's called the Light in Babylon, which is such an interesting name that, you know, she's this joyous, uplifted voice singing out in the realm of Babylon. And because she was a gypsy, Roma, I looked up with the Nazis, the Ukrainians, the Poles, the Austrians did to the gypsies, the Roma population.
Yeah.
Even now, as I think about it, I want to vomit. Somewhere between a quarter and half of the entire Roma population was not just killed. They were all brutalized. They were put into stunningly unhealthy conditions where there was no food, no water, no medicine, where enormous numbers had died. The ones that survived were rounded up and taken to Auschwitz and other concentration camps to become slave labor. And so many others, after being physically abused, were mass murdered. And it happened over and over and over again. One of the places, of course, is the Ukraine. I'd tell you what, if you're Ukrainian, I have no sympathy for you. What you did is reprehensible. Poland, same thing. Austria, same thing. Germany, of course. God's going to hold all those people accountable. And, you know, I was thinking, as I was reading these horrible the tales that I just read, just go to Wikipedia and study the genocide that was perpetuated on the gypsies, the Roma population. And then I think of the Russians going through Germany and gang raping the women and sending the German men that had survived off to prisons in Siberia, you know, for 20 or 30 years. And for the first time in my life, I say, no, I have no sympathy. I truly, they got what they deserved. I know that sounds harsh. But if you read, what they allowed to happen with their sons and husbands did, you know, they deserved it. So it is, so too it's going to happen. And yeah, I was going to hold them accountable. It is really important that God holds those who perpetrated great harm on people accountable. I began the first volume of Observations for a Time. I had an opportunity to give it to a secular Jewish family that I met while cruising a week ago. And I warned them. They were atheists and were just delighted to find somebody who had done research in these subjects that had also come to condemn religion and politics. And I said, now, you know, I know you're an atheist. I'm not. And that you hate religion. But if you're politically correct, you're going to hate what I wrote. Because the first sentence in Volume 1 of Observations of Our Time is hate is a virtue. And that's what God is conveying here. We ought to hate rape and rapists, pedophiles and pedophilia, mass murder, and those who perpetuate that crime. We ought to hate those who have deceived in the name of God. We ought to hate them for what they've done. And God's going to hold them accountable. He has to be fair. So it says that, for surely Yahweh, their God, will be mindful of them, returning and restoring them from captivity. They were, and he did. In the greatest transformation in human history, Jews, or more correctly, Yahudim, rose out of the ashes of the Third Reich's gas chambers to live among the open pastures of the Promised Land. the Muslims who had sought to have them exterminated rather than allow them to return home will be exterminated instead.
Good.
It is as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many reassuring truths reverberating throughout this prophecy. Let's just consider a few. First, there is no room for replacement theology or Christianity. Yahudim, or Yahweh's beloved, Yahweh remains mindful of the chosen people and has not switched his loyalties toward a church or Gentile nations. He made a promise to Abraham, and he is going to keep it. This is the fulfillment of the parable of the prodigal son. The father is God himself, and the lost son is Yahudah. The feast will occur on Yom Kippurim, the day of reconciliations. Second, to express genuine love, we must follow God's example and appreciate who, what, why, and how to hate. Protecting those we love necessitates learning to use our minds and our words to thwart their lethal and imminent threats. Now, a lot of people think that hate leads to violence. No. Righteous indignation ought to lead to using words to properly, accurately expose and condemn that which is malignant, harmful, injurious.
Well, you use
That's what we ought to do. If you can't use your words to express it, don't bother. God's going to be violent, but the lives that he will snuff out, he enabled. So he's not taking anything away from anyone. We don't have that license. And we ought not want that responsibility. What were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, you used to use that example I thought was very good for that in regards to the thousands or the millions of people who remember the Ku Klux Klan when they exposed it for what it was, and
mm-hmm.
newspapers and so forth, and it diminished their roles, diminished down to just a few wackos. I mean, in a very short period of time. And all those shows you did with IQ and yourself talking, you know, it should have been, those things should have exposed if they had gotten airtime the way they should have. You know, in
yeah.
other places, it would have exposed Islam. And now we're
yeah.
supposed with questioning Paul, all of those things. The trouble is they just won't allow it.
Correct. They won't allow
the truth
it. No,
is
that's
never
why well, yeah, I did another 5 or 6 shows at the as a result of the work and the reputation of Jerry McLaughlin, my good friend, a covenant member, a wonderful man. And, you know, I did another 5 or 6, 7 interviews. And while they were all wonderful experiences, what I found is that the world of radio that I had left 6 or 7 years ago no longer exists. That while the hosts were not prone to embrace the truth that I articulated, they were eager to have their audience hear it, and they were unwilling to challenge it. That is not the case now. The case now is that political correctness relative to religious lies and political lies, patriotic lies, has become so pervasive, and the consequence of not being politically correct is so severe to one's career that there is no longer a market for the truth. The truth has
right.
no safe harbor.
I know it's true. It's just frightening to hear.
It's sad to hear. But, you know, I don't. It doesn't bother me at all. The reason it doesn't bother me at all is I don't enjoy doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I won't turn it down because, you know, it's the deal I made with Yah, but I don't enjoy doing it. What I enjoy doing is what I got to do today. I went through and shared the insights from from the prophetic statements that I had translated, and that is fun. Oh, yeah, to write them and then to read them, and then know one day others will read them, and then we'll talk about them on the show. That's fun. But the radio, no. Now, Yahweh has stored up this insightful treasure, as Zephaniah's name means, for his children to find. He stored up long ago, but it does break my heart that his children have neglected it. But the words he chose are so loving, so tender, so joyful, so compelling, even compassionate and reassuring, that they will resonate one day. You know, I'm a goy, and I'm moved to tears. You know, I can't read this without choking up. And what about those of you for whom this promise was made, for those whom this land was given? The truth isn't only sweet, it's bitter too. For Yehudah, for those who call themselves Jews, these embittered words ought to sound sweet in your ears and become a balm for your souls. This is Zephaniah 2:8. I have heard the shameful taunts of Moab and the abusive rhetoric of the descendants of Ammon, such that they have insulted and ridiculed, annoying my people, making boastful statements over their territory and especially their borders. This is God speaking of our time. And he's listened to the shameful taunts of Moab. So Moab would represent those who are making shameful taunts about Israel. Every nation on earth that promotes a two-state solution, a land for peace deal, all of those who are part of the boycott Israel movement that's so popular in academia, all of those who are anti-Semitic, all of those who promote just blame the Jews conspiracies. I have heard the shameful taunts of Moab. Wear the badge. Moab, who is your daddy? And the abusive rhetoric of Ammon. Ammon means that which pertains to the nation or people. The children of Ben-Ami, the offspring of my nation. God's going to make a connection here in a moment that speaks of them being authoritarian terrorists. Ammon represents Islam and the Islamic nations. Moab represents the Christian nations and those that are socialist, secular, humanist. I have listened to the shameful taunts of Pauline Christians and socialist, secular, humanists and the abusive rhetoric of the descendants of Islam, such that they have insulted and ridiculed, annoying my people, making boastful statements over their territory, especially their borders. Now, that's extraordinary. Where else do you hear the world clamoring en masse that your borders are unjust, your borders are unlawful, your borders have to be cut back? What other country on earth? I can name one.
States. I was going to say, there, at least for a while, there was with India and Pakistan.
Yeah, but then the Indians gave the Muslims Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They did. Or the British separated them, so they didn't have to fight.
Well, actually, I'm not sure the British were responsible for that.
Well,
I mean, the British gave up India, and then the Indians gave up the Muslims.
Right.
That's kind of how
I remember back in like the late 90s, early 2000s, there was like a whole thing with the city of Kashmir, and there was argument over it was, and they were fighting over that. But otherwise, there's not really much I can
but
think of.
But there is no international outcry telling the Indians that they need to give up Kashmir, or that the Muslims that they need to give up Kashmir. There's no such thing.
No.
You got two nations fighting over where the line should be drawn, and that's it. Israel, the borders of Israel. Even every map that you look at will have lines drawn relative to Israel that show disputed areas.
Mm-hmm.
You read an article on the West Bank. on Gaza, and it will specifically say on land occupied illegally by Israel. You know, conquered during the such and such a war. And illegally occupied. It's the only nation on earth where this occurs. And God wrote about this 3,000 years ago. Well, actually, probably 2,500 years ago.
About 6.
Isn't that profound? Yeah, that the specific taunts would be about their borders, their territory. Well, since Yahweh has re-entered the promised land twice after, or Israel has re-entered the promised land twice, after being held in captivity, first out of the lion's den in Babylon, and then out of the concentration camps in Nazi-occupied Europe. On its own merits, some might discount the prophetic implications of 2:7, suggesting that it pertains to the earlier fulfillment and not to our time when the State of Israel was reestablished in 1948. But when combined with 2:8, which will follow, there's no doubt that Yahweh was predicting the miracle rebirth of Yisrael, which we witnessed 70 years ago. We know this because ancient civilizations, the likes of Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Greece, and Imperial Rome, didn't taunt or mock. They went straight for the jugular and killed. With them, it wasn't words, and that there was no way to effectively communicate between foes, but instead swords. Therefore, all of the abusive rhetoric and the insulting and annoying ridicule is a modern contrivance that is, with the exception of Islam, a religion born to annoy and then annihilate Jews in the 7th century CE. On behalf of the adversary, Muslims have woven mockery into the chorus of their hymns. But more than this, it is only now in the past 70 years that the Yabul, the borders of Yisrael, have been the object of confused contempt and irrational defiance. Yeah, irrational, confused, calling people Palestinians, calling the land Palestine, saying that there's
a
two-state solution, the right of return, refugees, illegal occupation. And it's these details that make Yahweh's prophetic testimony resonate within us, inspiring us. If I were to provide you with the entirety of the Hebrew lexicon and ask you to describe how the amalgamation comprising the modern manifestation of Moab, these liberal multiculturalists and conservative Christians, along with the fakestinians, the Palestinians, they are supporting, are making a mockery of the Holy Land, I dare say you could do no better than what we just read. And yes, let's not lose sight of the fact that the anti-Semitic political entities, the religious institutions and conspiratorial blogs making these boastful statements are being equated with Moab and Ammon, the descendants of Lot's incestuous encounters with his daughters, the legacy of Sodom and Gomorrah. It has been 4,000 years, but the worst of man has come back to haunt the world and infect the land. The secular incarnation of Moab has claimed that God is dead, while the sectarian personification protests that the Jews killed Jesus, thrusting their portrayals of their dead God on a stick in their faces, however me thinks otherwise. Therefore, as I live, Yahweh declares, well in advance of it occurring, who dispatches the vast array of spiritual implements, the Almighty God of Yisrael, surely Moab, those of a questionable father, shall for an ongoing period of time actually become very similar to Sodom, scorched. And the descendants of Ammon, pertaining to the family, shall be as Amora, authoritarian manipulation, a place owned and possessed by prickly and irritating weeds and as salt pits, lifeless ruins. as was Sodom. Ammon shall be as Amorah. Socialist, secular humanism, and Pauline Christianity, from God's perspective, you're just like Sodom, and that ought to scare the bejesus out of you. Because you know what God did to that place. And even why he did it. And if you're part of one of the 55 dictatorial, tyrannical Islamic regimes on the planet, from God's point of view, you're just like Amorah. And you're going to be wiped out to the last. It's a pretty good place for us to start again and to continue our explanation of what Moab represents in today's world. What's the fate of Moab? And that's what Yeshaya 15 and 16 is all about. What is the fate of the modern incarnation of Moab? Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I had never studied Zephaniah before, of any consequence. And all I did for about a couple hours today, I just looked up his name, which is a terrific name.
Isn't it great?
Is pertaining to what he's talking about. But the good news in it, there were three themes that he used in his prophecy, and the first thing was the impending destruction of Jerusalem. He talks about that, the Yom Kippur, on the day of Yah, when God punishes all the nations of the world, which is what all the lexicons say.
Mm-hmm.
So it's no argument there. He's not coming back to embrace them. He's coming back to contradict them, and to restore Israel. Then the thing that really struck me, because of our love for the words that he used and the letters that he used, God's returning for his people to, and he's going to restore a pure language so they can call upon him and they can pronounce his name. I thought that was fabulous. I mean, I had, you know, that he wants to restore it right back to not only Hebrew, but to, I would think, to his original way he spoke when he talked to Moshe. So there's no question who he is. And then I thought you would appreciate that. The other theme that goes through Zephaniah,
mm-hmm,
is he's going to rejoice over his people with singing. And I wrote to the side where, you know, you can expect Doe to join in the song. I mean, so
we're going to be singing Doe's lyrics.
And, well,
right?
Doe's going to be singing them.
Right.
I think we probably will be singing along, too, but
Doe's going to be the lead singer. He's the songwriter and lead singer.
So
we're going to be singing these songs.
Yeah. So everybody's singing in, including Yahweh.
And guess what language we're going to be singing?
In Hebrew.
Yeah, that's right.
So how do you get, how can you, that took me 2 hours. I mean, it's a little more depth than that, but it took me 2 hours. How can you argue with that? Either you have to assume that Zephaniah is a total liar, or God's a liar, and this is not true. But after what you just read, before all that stuff that we just read, how can you deny this? You can't.
Yeah, how can you have three Abrahamic religions when Yahweh just said that all of those people that are represented by Ammon, which would be the Muslim countries, and every Fakistinian, Palestinian, is going to be wiped out to the last. And along with them, God is condemning Pauline Christians and socialist secular humanists.
Mm-hmm.
How can you talk about an Abrahamic religion when God's obviously going to drive them into the sea, wipe them out?
Exactly.
You know, he's not coming back for his church. It isn't Jesus Christ that's coming back. He's coming back for his people. He's coming back to his land. And he's returning with his Messiah. And that's Dode.
Yeah.
There is no room for replacement theology. There's no room for gospel of grace. There's no room for a Christian New Testament. There's no room for a religion of Christianity. God ends where he began, with his people and his home. He hadn't changed an iota.
No.
The the prophecies that will be fulfilled in the last days, and the people to whom the prophecies were originally given have something in common. Same DNA,
yeah.
Same language, same covenant, same God, same country.
Right. This stuff just gets better and better. Honest to goodness.
Yeah, and you know, and listen, we're mostly so you, JB, and I are Goyim.
Goyim.
And yet we're celebrating on behalf of Yahweh and the reconciliation of his family. And we're not celebrating Yisrael as it exists today. I mean, the constitution of Yisrael is 50% secular and 50% religious. Both parts are bad.
Yeah.
Yisrael today is protected by the IDF, not by Yahweh.
Yeah.
There aren't five people in all of Yisrael that no one uses Yahweh's name. I would be surprised if there were 10 covenant members in the entire country. We're not identifying with what Yisrael is, but what it's going to
what
become.
What it will be.
Yes.
And,
listen, I have, and I think many of us have, had some struggles here with the family. And I know what it's like to be frustrated that you can't fix it. Knowing that time is probably not a cure. You just can't fix it. It's really painful.
Yeah,
and yet the thought that it could one day be and would one day be reconciled and joyous and close and loving. This is what Yahweh yearns for. This is what Yahweh has poured his entire existence into. And we can celebrate this along with him. Because most of us, I included, can empathize and know how wonderful this would be. And you could do a lot worse than appreciating the desires and inclinations of the Creator of the universe and of sharing them and celebrating them and serving in a way that helps achieve what he wants done. It's a really, really good thing to be doing. And that is what we're doing.
Absolutely. Just a thrill.
Making God happy is a really, really, really satisfying experience.
Mm-hmm.
He has treasures. He has an inheritance. He's fun. He's brilliant. He's really, really good-natured. He's approachable. He's uplifting, nurturing, caring, providing all manner of leadership. And when we devote ourselves to doing what he once achieved, which is to reconcile his relationship with Yehudah and Yisrael, the rewards are enormous, not only in the hereafter, but in the right here and now. That's why I began the programs we talked about. Are you satisfied?
Mm-hmm.
Is your life fulfilling? And yes, our lives are satisfied. They are fulfilling. We're doing what the Creator of the universe wants done. And the Creator of the universe is actually using us to accomplish his mission, something he thoroughly enjoys. And anything that brings him satisfaction and pleasure, there's nothing better we can do, nothing more rewarding. And by the way, we're not saying that in an egotistical way. We began talking about how really flawed and we are. It's just that what we're doing here is encouraging everyone who listens to join in. The more the merrier. You too.
Yes.
Can do this and more. We don't want to have an exclusive on the truth. We'd love everyone to embrace it. We know they won't, but we encourage everyone to. It's being offered to everyone. So with that, fellas, I've I'm telling you that who would have thought that we would have found such a treasure in Zephaniah? But without that statement,
yeah,
it's impossible to understand the connection between the story of ancient Sodom that we detailed and the prophecies in Yeshayah 15 and 16 about the ultimate destruction of Moab. You got to know who Moab is. And there's probably no clearer statement as to what Moab represents than this one. Although, we're going to get into a story that'll curl your toenails. And that is the destruction of Moab at the hands of Yehuda and Yisrael. It not only reveals who Moab is, it's going to reveal why Yisrael has suffered over the years. And that's what we'll begin this time next week.
All right. Once again, pleasure. A great pleasure.
I'm probably going to be out there.
It has been lots of fun. I'm delighted that Terry is beginning to feel much better, that your eyes are working beautifully, and that, JB, you're off now doing your new job, aren't you?
Yep.
Ah,
it's been
life is good.
Exciting.
Life is good.
And what did you say, JB? You're not going to make it next week?
Yeah, we're going to be out of town probably the next 2 weeks. We're taking advantage of the fact that we get off the entire week for July 4th, so we're going to go visit some family.
All right.
Okay.
Have a great time.
Have a good time.
I will.
All right, buddy.
All right, my friend.
All right, gentlemen.
Good night, family.
Have a good
shalom,
night.
Shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Good night. Shabbat shalom.
Night.